these dollars have continued to go up for more years than we expected.
A federal tax on guns and ammunition brings millions to the State Division of Wildlife. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two federal agencies come to two very different conclusions on the potential impact of the proposed Donlin Creek mine.
When we looked at all three major components of the project, it seemed like there was a significant potential for subsistence resources to be affected.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Amid all the budget gloom in Alaska, one branch of state government actually has more money than it can use. It's the Department of Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation. The division is largely funded by a federal tax on the sale of guns and ammunition, and sales nationwide are booming. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the Wildlife Conservation Division may have to give back a portion of its bounty.
It's a bizarre chain reaction kicked off by a mass shooting.
We do have some preliminary numbers of upwards of 14 people that are dead and upwards of 14 people that are injured.
Then calls for gun control.
All of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies.
Then people run out to buy more guns and ammo.
Gun sales actually surged over the weekend at stores all over the country.
And as customers go home with their new handguns and rifles, money pours into state wildlife conservation programs. That last link in the chain is thanks to Pittman Robertson, a 1937 federal law that levies an 11% tax on guns and ammo and funnels it to wildlife preservation. Steve Klein administers the program in Alaska for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Klein says Pittman Robertson is smart legislation.
I mean, it's a great model because it's basically the hunters and shooters that are paying the way. And then that money comes to the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state rights grants, and they do that, the management and research, and then that benefits the hunters and shooters with the ranges and healthy resources.
Alaska gets a substantial share of the national pie due to its geographic size. Maria Gladyszewski, deputy director of the State Wildlife Division, says the federal gun tax revenue pays for most of the 290 jobs in her division and most of the research they do.
It funds our core mission. It is the core of wildlife conservation in the nation.
With the surge in gun sales, the money the feds send to Alaska has gone up and up. Gladyszewski says the total bounced around $8 or $9 million a year in the early 2000s. In 2010, it hit $20 million. Last year, Alaska's share was almost $35 million, plus another $1.4 million for hunter safety and gun ranges. Gladyszewski says her division is not growing at the same rapid pace.
Because we viewed it as a bubble, you don't want to organize your staffing around funding that is probably going to come back down.
The state has 2 years to spend each year's allotment. Gladyszewski says the state has made use of its full allocation every year, until now.
These dollars have continued to go up for more years than we expected. So we will likely revert some money for the first time in September.
That's right. They're going to give money back to the feds. Gladyszewski says it will be at least $2 million.
We're, of course, facing the same travel restrictions and spending restrictions that other state agencies are. And so we might even leave some more on the table depending on how that goes.
The other problem is the required 3-to-1 match. So to receive $30 million, Gladyszewski says the state has to contribute $10 million.
We basically, at this point, don't have enough to match all of the federal dollars.
The Wildlife Division gets money from the sales of state hunting licenses and tags, but they amount to only about $8 million. Hunting and outdoors groups are now rallying to increase the license fees, which haven't gone up since the early 1990s. Juneau resident Ron Somerville, a board member of the Territorial Sportsman and a former Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner, says it'd be a shame to leave federal conservation money on the table, so they need to raise money for the match.
Resident hunting is 25, we're recommending 40. In other words, in most cases, rather than argue about a dollar here, a dollar there, we raised everything by 85% or something close to that.
A bill to increase the hunting license fees passed the State House last year, but Somerville says it doesn't raise them high enough.
That's pretty crazy. You're saying we're sportsmen, please raise the fees that we pay.
Yeah. We're the only group in Alaska that's asking the government to allow us to pay more money.
Even if they succeed in raising license fees, the goalposts continue to move. It looks like national gun sales may have hit an all-time high in December. That would send even more Pittman-Robertson money to Alaska, if the state can cope with the prosperity. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
An association of retired state workers has filed a lawsuit saying state cuts to dental benefits violate the Alaska Constitution. The Retired Public Employees of Alaska says changes in 2014 to optional dental, vision, audio, and long-term care insurance must be reversed. On Friday, the association filed a lawsuit against Department of Administration Commissioner Sheldon Fisher in Superior Court in Anchorage. The lawsuit lists eight changes that it says violate a provision of the Constitution. This provision says accrued retirement benefits for public employees shall not be diminished or impaired. The lawsuit seeks to reinstate benefits similar to those before 2014, when Moda Health began operating the dental plan. Anchorage resident Brad Owens is a plan beneficiary through his wife, a retired state worker. He says the changes affect annual fluoride treatments.
The Moda plan basically took away the fluoride treatment from a determination by the dentist as to whether or not it was appropriate or necessary. And just said it's no longer available. It's something that you have to pay for by yourself.
State officials say that a move by the state last week to put Moda under supervision due to the company's poor financial condition won't affect the dental plans. A ruling by the Alaska Supreme Court on Friday has strengthened the role municipalities have in setting the tax value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and similar structures. The ruling overturns a lower court decision that said the Alaska Department of Revenue had the final say. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
For years, Fairbanks, Barrow, and Valdez have been wrangling in court with the owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS, over its taxation value. Friday's ruling by the Alaska Supreme Court didn't directly address that issue. Rather, it ruled on who gets final say as to value, the Department of Revenue or the Volunteer State Assessment Review Board, or SARB. City of Valdez attorney Robin Brenna argued before the justices the legislature was clear who had jurisdiction.
I don't think there is any reasonable reading of something saying the board shall hear appeals to mean that the board shall not hear appeals on taxability.
Brenna said the Department of Revenue regulations allow pipeline owners to secretly appeal to the Department of Revenue a taxation question without municipalities like Valdez being any the wiser. The matter is important to Valdez, Fairbanks, and Barrow, who receive millions of dollars from taxing the pipeline. Friday's ruling by the state Supreme Court ruled in Valdez's favor, striking down the Department of Revenue regulation. Brenna says he hopes with this issue behind them, Valdez officials can take up a separate agreement recently struck with pipeline owners setting the tax value of the pipeline at $8 billion through 2020. Barrow and Fairbanks have officially signed on to the deal, but Valdez has yet to. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort in Sitka to make sure deer hunting season doesn't draw more birds to the airport.
there's a lot of steps between somebody pitching some animal remains overboard or leaving them on the beach and planes crashing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Congress has approved to conclude several land transfers Alaska's congressional delegation has pursued for years. One of them is at Point Spencer to advance the possible construction of an Arctic deep water port near Nome. Bering Straits Native Corporation hopes to develop the port in partnership with the state of Alaska. The bill cleared the U.S. House tonight. It also includes a land handover in Tok to allow the Tanana Chiefs Conference to continue running a counseling center and transfers federal property to village corporations in the Pribilofs. The legislation continues the effort to acquire a new icebreaker. An amendment co-sponsored by Senator Dan Sullivan authorizes another $14 million toward the billion-dollar project. The bill now goes to the president for his signature. Blue Crest Energy, the company drilling for oil north of Anchor Point, gave an update on their effort at a forum in Kenai last week. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
Blue Crest Energy's president and CEO, Benjamin Johnson, gave an update on the company's progress drilling onshore oil wells into the cosmopolitan fields of Cook Inlet. He said they are on schedule to frack their first well this summer.
And we will start drilling in May, June timeframe.
Johnson says the company will finish two more wells by the end of this year or the beginning of 2017. Blue Crest officials have said they plan to eventually produce up to 17,000 barrels of oil per day. Johnson also stressed the company probably won't develop the natural gas in Cosmopolitan if the legislature makes big changes to the state's tax credit program.
We have our permits, we have the equipment, the plans, the designs, everything's ready to go for the gas drilling. We could be drilling April 15th if we knew that the tax credits or something similar or equivalent were going to be in place. But without it, it's not going
to
happen.
The credits are cash paid to exploration companies to offset the costs of developing oil and gas reserves. They are a tool to encourage companies to drill. If Blue Crest decides to pursue the gas, they'll have to drill offshore. There's an offshore rig they can use in Seward, owned by Spartan Offshore Drilling. Johnson says Blue Crest can wait on the gas, but if Spartan moves the rig while the tax credit question is answered, he doesn't know when another will be available. On the oil side, Johnson says Blue Crest is continuing development for now because they've spent too much money to just stop, and the work is contracted into the end of this year. He says Blue Crest has already earned $45 million in credits that would be paid this year.
This year is a big spending year for us, but it's a little over $100 million that would be paid in 2017 for the money that we spend in 2016.
If the credits stay the same, Johnson says the state will make a lot of money. He says they estimate a 300% return for the state just from oil royalties.
So it's an investment, not a cost.
And he says that's on top of a 12.5% tax on every barrel of oil sold. Johnson admits never changing the tax credit structure would be a hard thing to do, especially if the price of oil stays so low. He says he's asking the state to not make a change for at least the next 12 months. The Industry Outlook Forum was sponsored by the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Quinton Chandler.
Two federal agencies have come to two different conclusions on the potential effects the proposed Donlin Creek mine could have on subsistence along the Kuskokwim River. The site sits 10 miles north of the village of Crooked Creek. Donlin estimates it could excavate 34 million ounces of gold over almost three decades. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The Army Corps of Engineers predicts the mine would have a minor to moderate impact on subsistence practices and resources. On the other hand, Alan Bittner, field manager for the Bureau of Land Management, says the Bureau has a different take.
When we looked at all three major components of the project, it seemed like there was a significant potential for subsistence resources to be affected.
Those big components include the mine itself, barging on the Kuskokwim, and a natural gas pipeline running over 300 miles from Anchorage to the mine site.
Simply put, this is a pretty big project. There's pretty big components to it. And our finding is that the possibility exists in any of those major components to affect subsistence resources.
The Army Corps contracted the environmental and engineering firm AECOM to create the mine's draft environmental impact statement. The firm is operating under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, while the BLM is working under ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The Army Corps did not respond to calls for comment on this story in time for broadcast. Bittner says the agency's differing predictions come from different biologists working under different federal laws with different standards.
So if there's, you know, a professional biologist for the contractor, AECOM may feel one way and then is working under a certain law and certain guidance of that law. And then there's also, you know, a professional biologist on the BLM side that's working under a different law and drawing their preliminary conclusions as well.
The BLM got involved when Donnellan applied for a right-of-way permit for a natural gas pipeline and a fiber optic cable stretching across BLM property. Now the BLM has to analyze the subsistence impact for the entire project, not just the pipeline path. And the Bureau can declare one of two options.
Either that the project will not significantly affect subsistence resources, or that it may significantly affect subsistence resources.
What the BLM means by significant, Bittner says, is not well defined.
It becomes a professional judgment on professional biologists that are writing about subsistence impacts as to what significant is. And again, this is a preliminary finding that that potential exists.
To make their final judgment, the BLM is predicting if the subsistence resources and the way to get to those resources will be affected. To help the BLM make this analysis, Bittner says the Bureau is collecting public testimony in communities where the BLM determines subsistence resources could be affected by the proposed mine.
So our preliminary finding is that it may, and we really need to hear from people about whether that's true for them or not, the individuals that are actually in the communities, in subsistence communities, and they are subsistence as a part of their life.
The BLM will be holding a public hearing to collect such comments tonight in Bethel. More meetings are scheduled in Kuskokwim communities throughout the month. Comments can also be submitted online at donlingoldeis.com. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
A moose hunting trip ended in tragedy this weekend in Togiak after a boat carrying three men and three moose were swamped in heavy surf. The three men, who all died, were attempting to cross from the mouth of the Togiak River back to the village just after dark Saturday. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
James Toots, Eric Kupchayak, and Larry Arnariak headed upriver Friday as the regular winter moose hunting season was winding down. As far as is known, the three hunters bagged three moose and headed back Saturday. The weather turned foul, and strong east winds pinned the trio near the mouth of the Togiak River. They made a phone call to let village authorities know they were having trouble, but apparently tried to run the short distance from the mouth back to the village Saturday after dark. Daryl Thompson spoke with KDLG Sunday afternoon.
The wind was 40 to 60 miles an hour, probably. Waves are pretty high, and it was dark. And there's ice, and they're right inside the side of the village. I mean, it's just not too far away, but waves swamped them, and they're in the water.
When they didn't arrive, a volunteer effort to go after them was cobbled together, and eventually a boat was launched. The U.S. Coast Guard was notified at 11 p.m., and a Jayhawk helicopter left Air Station Kodiak at 11:40. That helicopter and a follow-on HC-130 fixed-wing aircraft were waved off on account of the high winds and low visibility. Volunteers found the body of Eric Kupchaik Saturday night. Thompson says in the morning, word came that Toots and Arnariak had been found as well.
We woke up and one of the village leaders would go on to VHF and tell us that the two that we didn't find right away were found. So that was a relief. I did not want to have the waves of the ocean take them and that may not be covered.
How the boat was swamped or why the men didn't head back upriver and wait for safer conditions may never be known. Troopers say none were found to be wearing life jackets either. They were traveling in a homemade welded aluminum skiff, described as flat bottom with steep sides. Elder Pete Abraham says it was a seaworthy craft, but believes they were overloaded with three moose for the conditions. Abraham says he was frustrated by what he thinks was a preventable tragedy.
We need more elders to talk to the young generation about boating, sledding, whatever, snow machining. Not enough people, young people, to listen to these things here. But we need more. We need more encouragement to young, older generation, talk to the young generation about being cautious out there.
Thompson says James Toots, Eric Kupchaik, and Larry Arnariak died doing what they love, working to provide for themselves and their families. While the men were out hunting, the Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order extending the 17A moose season another month, citing the poor winter travel conditions. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Throughout this year's hunting season, Sitka's airport has been contending with an unusual issue, dead deer. Carcasses have been washing up on the runway since November, attracting birds. And that has posed a big problem to airport operations. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
You know those contraptions where a hammer hits a ball, which drops into a bucket and then cracks an egg? Well, this story is set inside Sitka's very own Rube Goldberg machine. And it all begins with a dead deer.
There's a lot of steps between somebody pitching some animal remains overboard or leaving them on the beach and planes crashing.
Heather Boucher works for the U.S. Department of Agriculture as a wildlife specialist. Her job is to clear the runway of wildlife that could interfere with air traffic. Mostly it's creatures of the sky, eagles, seagulls, and ducks. But lately, Boucher's biggest nemesis is deer.
Sitka Radio, Wildlife 2.
Carcasses, to be precise, that have been washing up on the runway ever since the subsistence hunting season opened on November 1st.
Wildlife 2, we'll show you on.
Wildlife 2, thanks.
In her truck, Boucher speeds down the runway, which is fully exposed. It's like a tarmac popsicle sticking out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Because of its design, carcasses tend to wash up on or near the runway every week. It's like Las Vegas when the buffet is called, except for birds.
Some of these coves really act as a catch-all. You'll see all sorts of debris.
Boucher slows down as we near a windsock. She sees something. She scrambles down some rocks. Someone's sneaker is floating in there.
Yep, all kinds of debris.
It's debris soup, really. But with her keen eyes, Boucher spies a white tuft of hair.
See a little bit right there?
It's a deer head.
Oh my God, yes!
She nabs it and climbs up the rock wall triumphant, her blue gloved hand holding that deer head up high.
Oh, it smells.
Yep.
It smells like death.
Yep.
Boucher chucks it into the back of her truck. One section is smeared with blood and animal parts, so she has to wash it pretty often, and drives off the runway. Now, think about it. All of this collection work for one deer head that could theoretically attract a bird that could theoretically collide with a plane. Is it worth all the fuss? Boucher said that on a runway as exposed and wild as Sitka's, it's essential.
Chances are it's going to severely damage the turbine to the point of completely destroying that engine.
In 2010, an eagle flew straight into the engine of a Boeing 737 that was roaring down Sitka's runway. No one was hurt. Commercial planes have two engines. But at other airports across the country, wildlife strikes have downed planes and killed passengers before. In 2009, pilots had to make an emergency landing on the Hudson River in New York City after birds knocked out both engines. Public pressure from that event motivated the Federal Aviation Authority to release data that year, which reported 60,000 bird strikes since 2000. Basically, it can happen to any plane with any bird. All it takes is some bad timing. And Boucher said the USDA doesn't want to take that risk.
Because we're not going to have a miracle on the Hudson in Sitka.
Why not?
Well, I mean, look at it. There's too many rocks, at the very least. And how many times are you on a plane where you know the other people on the plane? Always. There's always people you know on that plane. And the way the flight runs from Seattle to Anchorage, if there was something horrible that happened because of a bird strike, there'd be no way that this whole community wasn't impacted, much less, you know, all of Southeast Alaska.
Phil Mooney, the area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, urges those hunting to be more conscious of this very real connection between sea and sky. And that means not dumping your carcass on the side of the road.
Don't put it on the roadside. Don't throw it in the water, particularly. If you can put it in your garbage can, that's great.
Mooney sympathizes with those Sitkins who want to return the wildlife carcasses back to nature, but stresses that that kind of thinking is too risky in a city of 9,000 people with over half a dozen daily flights.
Okay, this one deer carcass isn't going to hurt anything, or these two deer carcasses, but take that times how many hunters we've got out there and a good deer year like there, and it gets to be a problem.
So they're going to take off.
Back on the runway, Boucher has just enough time to scatter a group of ducks. These are living ducks. So she uses pyrotechnics shot out of a gun. This one is blue with sparkles coming out the back. It's called a silver comet. Boucher clearly loves her job.
This is all nice and clear now.
Boucher's eyes travel upward as the noon plane takes off into the sky. And she says that if she could have one superpower, it would be to talk to animals and tell them not to hang out on the runway, as beautiful as it may be. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com.
Happy New Year! Start the year off right by filing your 2016 PFD application. Don't forget to sign your application electronically or by printing a signature page. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st, 2016. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.